committee meeting on state government innovation and veterans will come to order. Today is Wednesday, March 23rd. And just a quick little housekeeping. The reason I waited until about 10 after is Minority Leader Senator Bach has a bill that we do need to move. It's non-controversial. It'll move real quick. So what we're going to do is we're going to start with the veterans here. And once Senator Bach does show up, we're going to take a quick little recess, get him in and out, and then we'll come back, if that's all right, with everyone. Senator Thompson or Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the committee adopt the portions of the spreadsheet pertaining to military and veterans affairs for inclusion in the omnibus bill.
On Senator Gazelka's motion, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. So prevails. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that Article 2 of the Delete All Amendment be adopted.
All right. Thank you, Senator Gazelka. We'll start our testimony now. General Nash, I believe you're up front here.
Chair.
Thank you.
Senator, staff. I'm with Mr. Terry Palmer today, the Department of Military Affairs Comptroller.
Please state your name and you may proceed.
Senator Perry, committee members, staff. Terry Palmer, the Comptroller for the Department of Military Affairs. Did you want a quick overview of our budget?
I think that would be fine, sir.
I think in terms of background, I think you understand how busy the Minnesota Guard is. There's currently 2,400 members getting ready for deployment this summer, and 95% of the total DMA budget is federal money, but that portion of the federal funds that you see in the state budget, which varies between $40 and $80 million a year, requires some effort of maintenance on the part of the Department of Military Affairs. So in order to accept that federal money, we have to account for it. We have to hire people. We have to do lots of things that agencies typically do with state money. But so it has a – so the state funding of the agency, you know, that allows us to accept that federal funding is very important to us, and that's the majority of the funding in one of the appropriations. As we went through our budget goals, we wanted to make sure we had sufficient staff to respond to the needs of the National Guard units and soldiers as they were ordered to stay active duty. Currently, there are Minnesota National Guard members preparing for the inevitable flood that will come this spring, and hope to be prepared to keep the citizens and the resources of the state safe. And we also need staff to conduct the business and coordinate with state government, plan and prepare for state emergency response, support National Guard members and their families, and then support National Guard programs. And one of the big roles that the Adjutant General has as a responsibility is to take care of the armory facilities that are typically funded predominantly with federal money for construction, but then the state accepts the obligation to maintain those buildings over their life. So we essentially have three appropriations. One is the maintenance of training facilities, which is $6.66 million per year. There's a general support appropriation for $2.363 million per year. There's an enlistment incentives appropriation that includes the tuition reimbursement program, which is $10.348 million a year. And the budget that you've presented, Mr. Chairman, includes a one-time supplemental funding of $1.5 million a year for a total of $11.848 million for enlistment incentives for the Minnesota National Guard. That brings our total budget for FY13 at $20.871 million per year. In terms of those maintenance of training facilities dollars, that $6.66 million, what that really does is provides the money for utility costs for the state-owned facilities, which are all the armories located around the state, plus the facilities at Camp Ripley, which is about $2.6 million for.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
Can I ask one question?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Palmer, there was reference for the various accounts for the Guard for emergencies and, you know, with the obvious planning now for the flooding that's going to happen, are we adequately reserved for that contingency?
Mr. Palmer.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wager, the National Guard has access to general fund money through an open appropriation once the governor declares an emergency. So we I think there's a dollar amount included in the budget, what you'll see in the budget documents, but that's really an average of the amount of money that's netted out over the years. So in this case, we would expect that at some point the governor's going to declare an emergency. We're going to have to request funding to pay for the mission of the National Guard and the employees. And then at some point, we would expect that FEMA would reimburse the state either at 75% or 100%, depending on the severity of the emergency. So the vast majority of that money would come back into the state general fund, but there would be a cash flow issue for several months, maybe longer.
Senator Wager.
Thank you.
Okay. Proceed.
And then the Department of Military Affairs is very interlocked with the federal government. We have a series of cooperative agreement appendices that provide services where we hire people or pay for partial costs for facilities. So in the maintenance of training facilities budget, just over $1 million is the state match that's required to operate the two Air National Guard bases at Duluth and Minneapolis. And then there's a smaller amount that's required for Army Guard facilities at Camp Ripley, which are predominantly funded 100% federally. So, and there's a payment for new construction bonds. We have contracting and construction, and then public works and state and wide indirect costs all come out of that same budget. So the bottom line is there's about it's about $27,000 available per facility for cleaning and for stocking of equipment and supplies that every building needs to have, restroom supplies and all that. And it works out to about 90 cents a square foot, which is very low relative to the actual dollars people typically budget for, but we make do with the money. The general support appropriation for each year, the biennium is $2.363 million. Out of that, we pay about $1.6 million in compensation costs. The Veterans Service Building rent comes out of that budget. It's $565,000. We expect that also to increase to $587,000 in FY13. So there's a bit of an increase we have to absorb there. We pay about $20,000 extra in utility payments for the Veterans Service Building lease because the National Guard has their servers for the National Guard located in that building. So that means there's about $168,000 left for all of the other activities. And when you look at it in terms of the total appropriation for general support, that's 90% of that appropriation is, if you take rent out, is employee costs. So it's very difficult for us. As we'll talk later, there's very few state employees that are 100% funded out of the general fund in military affairs. We see similar budget pressures on the enlistment incentives program, too. We recently made a change that capped the amount of money to any particular individual at because some of the young soldiers were taking more classes than we would typically see, and we wanted to make sure there's enough money for each participant to have something, so we capped the amount of money available. We hope that'll bring the FY11 dollar amount down to the actual amount remaining, and then for FY12 and 13, $1.5 million is what we project will be required to keep the tuition reimbursement program funded at the 100% level with the caveat of the cap amount. The average participant's about $4,400 per year, so we're not affecting many people by capping the tuition reimbursement payment. It allows it to spread out over a greater number of people in the Guard, so we think that's the proper way to attack that. If you'd like me to get into more of the detailed Senate budget pieces, I'd be happy to do that, Senator Perry.
If we We're going to set aside discussion of the omnibus bill and take up Senate File 732 real quick. As I mentioned early on, Senator Bach, please come forward. We're going to take a little recess so we can get you in and out of here quick. And I, Senator Bach, Madam Ingebrigtsen wanted me to remind you that this is a chairman's position up here, and he just said that that I was supposed to remind you of that, Senator.
Mr. Chairman, I would have thought that the chair of the Environment Committee had more important things to talk to the chair of the powerful State Government Finance Committee about. But thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 732, as amended by the Environment Committee, deals with a water quality standard that the PCA has relative to water discharge permits. And I know many of us felt that the environmental permitting bill that was passed earlier this session was important, but it was nowhere near as important as this bill. What the situation we currently find ourselves in, and I'll just briefly explain it, is there was some research, observational research done for a PhD thesis or some kind of a paper that an employee of DNR was writing back in the 40s. And he observed wild rice growing in a couple hundred lakes in Minnesota and determined based on his observations that wild rice really grew best in water with less than 10 milligrams per liter of sulfites in the water. That was done in the 40s. In the 70s, the PCA adopted by rule that 10 milligrams per liter as the standard in discharge permits. Even though they adopted it as a rule in discharge permits in the 70s, except in one instance, it is not in anybody's discharge permit. No place in the state. So even though they have a rule, it has never been applied to discharge permits. The issue was raised during the PolyMet EIS by some people that were reviewing all of the documentation. And the 10 standard, the department was made aware of it, and there's a feeling now on the part of the department that they need to start enforcing this 10-part rule because it's in rules. And the federal EPA has signed off on it. So they're in a position now that this is kind of public that they need to start putting this into permits. There are over 300 municipal wastewater treatment plants in this state that discharge into what is potentially a wild rice-bearing water body that when they go to have their permits renewed for their municipal wastewater treatment permits are going to have this standard applied to them. There are a couple hundred industrial sites in the state, industrial permits, that are going to be facing the same thing. The one exception, and I'll say it again, this is not in any discharge permit in the state any place except in the most recent permit at U.S. Steel at Keewatin. They have applied for a permit for an expansion at Keewatin. They have to start by dewatering an existing pit so they can start mining in there. The department felt like they had to apply this 10 standard. This is the first industrial permit since there's been all the public awareness about it. So what they did in the case of U.S. Steel at Keewatin is they gave them 8 years, an 8-year window to get to that standard of 10. I think that's an admission that the standard probably not going to work. U.S. Steel has told me that the cost of them, if they had to upfront do their design and their engineering for the standard of 10, it would add $250 million to the cost of that expansion at Keewatin. And I think the problem, Mr. Chairman, the real reason that we're concerned is there really is no scientific research to this 10 number. So the bill needs to go to finance because there's an appropriation of $1.5 million in here to actually conduct a scientific study on what is the appropriate number that wild rice will grow in. And if it's 10, Mr. Chairman, then the standard should be 10. But if it turns out that it's something different than that, so what the bill does is it suspends the current 10 number, and it asks the department to do rulemaking to develop a new number by December 31st of 2012 based on the science that's currently out there. Accumulate all the studies that have been done and try to develop some kind of an interim number until the research can be completed. And then once the research is completed, and we don't know the protocol yet, there's language in here about the protocol, who they're going to involve, what they're going to study. Once the research is done, and it may take two or three growing seasons before we have the data necessary to make a good scientific observation of what the number should be, that once the research is completed, they then would go into the rulemaking process again and then put in rule the number that the scientific research found to be the appropriate number of milligrams per liter that could be in a discharge permit and not jeopardize native wild rice production. And I just want to be clear, Mr. Chairman, I understand wild rice. I live in wild rice country. I eat wild rice. I have wonderful relationships with the tribal governments in my district, and I in no way want to jeopardize our wild rice resource in this state. This is not what this is about. This is about getting some science behind what we think right now today, I think generally is agreed upon, is a very arbitrary number in law. So, Mr. Chairman, there's actually two sets of rulemaking in here, and that's why we're here. But thank you for allowing me to give you a brief description of what the bill is about.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for the committee here, Senator Carlson and I were in the committee last night in environment when Senator Bach presented it, and I really felt like it was a reasoned approach. He wasn't saying it should never be that. He was just asking for the science to confirm it. We actually asked some of the wild rice experts that were opposed to it if they could confirm at what level wild rice would grow at, and they really didn't know, which tells me that we need a study doing it, and in the meantime, suspending it so that we can keep going forward with the things we have, knowing that we haven't required it yet at all anyway. So I absolutely support this.
So, Mr. Chairman, actually, again, to Senator Gazelka's point, what it really does is maintain the status quo. I mean, we're going to continue on the path that we have been on relative to a sulfide discharge standard and try to develop some science based on what the right number should be. And I'll say it a second time. If that research comes back and says the number should be 10, I support 10. And I believe the industry has said if that's what it's going to take, if 10 is the right number, they support 10, and they'll spend whatever money they have to meet that.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you. Since I wasn't in environment last night, Mr. Chair and Senator Bach, what happens during that time that it's suspended? Can people go over that amount then, or that 10% or what?
Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, most discharges are over that amount now. It's just that it's never been in anybody's permit. So this just allows the permits that are in place to be able to continue while the department does some temporary rulemaking to look at a number other than 10 with the science that we currently have while the study goes on. And then once the study's completed, then they go into rulemaking and actually put in the new number into the rule. But I would argue what it does, Senator Goodwin, is it just maintains the status quo. What's troubling about the standard, Mr. Chairman, is the standard for drinking water is 250. And all of the drinking water in the Iron Range towns are about 10 to 20, what they actually draw out of the ground, out of the bedrock. So we just don't know what the right number should be. And so I guess what we're actually saying is let's just continue on the path we're on here until we get a scientific study done.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I don't want to delve too deeply into purview of the environmental committee, but I'll try to ask a simple question. Senator Bach, you know, of course, the anxiety is around, the wild rice beds, but also, you know, the other kind of fragile habitats, not so much about human health and drinking water, but, you know, the impact on the ecology and the ecosystem that might result from sulfide mining, up in, an area, those are cold water lakes, they're very, very sensitive. So what happens? I mean, is the plant going to be up and running with permits to discharge, you know, an amount of sulfate that might cause that damage? I mean, that's what folks are most concerned about.
Senator Bach.
I think, for me at least, Mr. Chairman, this is not about Polymet Mining Company. This is about, for me personally, this is about U.S. Steel at Keewatin. They want to make a major expansion there, and it's iron ore. We've been mining iron ore for 130 years in Minnesota. There's nothing new about what's going to happen to Keewatin. Actually, what they're proposing to do is reopen a line that used to run when National Steel owned the plant. And the 10 standard has never been in their permit. And but now it appears like we're going to start enforcing the 10 standard, and we're not going to get an expansion of 3.6 million tons of pellets a year, probably about 100 or more jobs at Keewatin because of a very arbitrary number. So the science on this is really important, Mr. Chairman. I want to get to the right number, and we don't know what that is today. And Senator Dibble, to your point, the House is going down a little different path on this. They actually are trying to pick an arbitrary, a new number. And I think they originally started at 250. Let's make the number the same as the drinking water standard. Well, I guess you'd think, well, geez, if we can drink it, we can probably grow rice in it. But the problem I think I have with their approach, and I discussed this with the governor this morning, and I've met with Commissioner Austin about this, the governor would like to get some solid science behind this so we can resume economic development. My understanding of the Senate's approach of developing a new interim rule while we do the science is that is likely more acceptable to the EPA. I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day, the Environmental Protection Agency will review any changes we make in our water quality standards. There is no point in us picking another arbitrary number and then ask the EPA to sign off on it when we have no science behind it. So developing, we think, and we'll learn more as we go forward, I want this bill to be something that puts Commissioner Austin in the strongest position with EPA so that we can get them to sign off on the changes that we're proposing to make while the study, while the research is being done. Today, at least, the discussions that I've had with the governor's office and with Commissioner Austin and with the state chamber, to the extent that they might know what the EPA might be willing to do, it seems like this approach, rather than the House approach, is the more sensible one.
Senator Dibble.
Well, just to follow up, but the conversation really did come up around in the context of Polymet, and, mm-hmm. and we know that those mines have the potential of leaching, you know, a lot of sulfates, you know, into the surface waters. I guess my simple question is, how quickly is it conceivable that Polymet will be up and running and operational?
Senator
Bach. Mr. Chairman, I don't have a clue. They've been, I think, 5 years in the permitting now, and I don't see any sign that their EIS has been published for final comment yet. So, but in any event, once the rule gets established, it'll be put into their permit, and whatever the rule is. I think the point is, what would be the point of putting 10 in when you know it's a total arbitrary number? The rulemaking in the bill allows the department to develop a new interim number that they're going to have to meet, based on the science that we have out there today.
Senator Bach, do you know what that interim number is? Do we have any idea?
I don't think the department knows either. I don't think anybody knows. I've seen there's a whole list of a number of studies that have been done relative to wild rice. They vary anywhere from 10 to 3,000. I mean, there are places in the state where they've found rice growing in water at concentrations of 3,000. So I don't have a clue. I just know there's studies all over the board on that issue.
And as I understand this, Senator Bach, this report is done at the end of this year?
The report that's in the bill that we ask for. We ask the department to do a report to the legislature by December of this year. The report that we're asking them to send us is not the rulemaking. The report is a report on how long is the scientific research going to take? When can we expect that to be done? Because it will take multiple growing seasons to know, to make good science, whether it's going to be two growing seasons or three growing seasons. So what we're asking is the report develop the protocol of how long is the wild rice research going to take, and the report is going to identify for us where are the discharges that go into some kind of a potential wild rice bearing water, because not all discharges go in. This standard only applies to discharges that go into a body of water that holds wild rice. So we don't know what all those are today. I don't know that anybody's ever put that together because they've never applied this standard to anybody's permit. So that's what the report is intended to do, develop the protocol, tell us when the research is going to be done, tell us what water bodies, so ultimately how many permits might eventually be impacted by a standard.
All right, Senator Wigger.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 732 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to finance.
On that motion, do we have any testifiers here in the crowd? Okay. On that motion that Senate File 732 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to finance, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
And Senator Ingebrigtsen's right over there if you'd like to.
Madam Ingebrigtsen?
A long night, I understand. Thank you. All right, if we could resume, thank you for your patience. And we'll resume hearing testimony. Again, thanks for the patience on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll go through the budget in a little more detail if you'd like. I'll try to follow the expanded spreadsheet that Mr. Lundin prepared for the committee, and we're on page 8 of that spreadsheet. And I'll try to give you a better sense of what these dollars actually provide in terms of resources or activities that are essential for the Minnesota National Guard, both Army and Air, to continue to function at the level they are. If you look at the first one, the Camp Ripley Holman Field appropriation, it's 885 and 887. There's actually... Camp Ripley's like a small city. They have a number of activities that have to occur. They have firefighters, they have security people, they have roads and grounds people, they have wastewater treatment facility, they also have facilities maintenance and repair people, and then they have facilities design staff, architect, engineer folks. And that amounts to 173 employees that are state employees at Camp Ripley. Of that, 11.25 FTE are state funded. There's 11 that are funded through money generated from the use of the billets at Camp Ripley, the sleeping quarters. So, and 150 of those people are federally funded FTE. So you can see the minimal support that's required by the state for these activities, but it does create one of the finest National Guard installations in the nation. In terms of the armory maintenance.
Mr. Palmer, I just want to back up here just in case somebody heard it the way I believe we're looking at 885 and 897, not 87.
I'm sorry, sir. That is correct.
Just wanted to clarify that.
Glasses aren't quite strong enough anymore.
I understand.
And then the next line that's pointed out is the armory maintenance. Again, we talked a little bit about what all that money went for, utilities and maintenance repair on the buildings. There's only 6.9 FTE in there, and that's three of those are state-funded FTE. But that's the maintenance and repair of all the armories. That's the utility costs and all those things that are required to keep those buildings open, clean, safe, and functional so that the National Guard soldiers can use them for the training purpose.
Mr. Palmer, how many facilities, armory facilities, do we have in the state?
There's 63 armories located around the state, Mr. Chairman.
And I'm, I would just, I know what they go through. General Nash knows of a first sergeant that I can remember even back in the late 60s, early 70s, how he never let the temperature in the Armory get below 40, and I can remember drill dates that it wasn't much above 40. So I know how well you watch those facilities.
Yes, sir, that is true. The next line is air base maintenance in the Twin Cities. That's the 133rd Airlift Wing, which has C-130s. That's the state's match that's required for, it's a 3-to-1 match with federal dollars, direct 3-to-1 match. But also what that means, there's 31.9 FTE funded in that activity, and only 4.9 of those are state. There's a lot more federal funding, as you can see. There's about $3.5 million that also come in through the state for security and other functions that we don't have to pay for. The airbase in the Twin Cities is responsible for about $68.5 million in economic activity in federal funding. So it's very important to the Twin Cities. And then the next line you'll see is for the Duluth Air Base, and again, there's a modest match there, $474,000 in FY12. That's a 4-to-1 match because of the way that, because that's a hot mission facility with F-16s. In that case, they bring in about $5.2 million in federal funding through the state system for security, firefighting. They too are like a small city in many regards. They have all those functions. But in this case, there's 74 employees, FTEs, I'm sorry, and then 4.4 of those are state-funded FTE. The Duluth Air National Guard is the ninth largest employer in Duluth region, and they're responsible for over $63 million in economic activity and federal funding that they receive for those programs. And then if we go down to the administrative services, this is more heavily state activities. It's the adjutant general and his staff, the people that do the planning, the people that do the accounting and procurement and the budgeting. In this case, there's 18.6 state FTE and 0.4 other FTE. And then in terms of the enlistment incentives, I think we've talked briefly about that. It's an extremely important program for the Minnesota Guard, both Army and Air, because it encourages young men and women to step up and serve their state and nation. It's been an extremely successful program. It's helped the Minnesota National Guard maintain a very high level of manning in their units. And the governor has recommended $1.5 million additional increase in that program for tuition reimbursement, and thankfully you've agreed to put in $1.5 million each year for the biennium for that program, which will again allow us to maintain that payment level at 100% of the tuition cost for most of the people that are participating in that program. And that predominantly goes back into state institutions, whether it's MinSCU or the University of Minnesota. A great percentage of that actually goes back into those institutions, and obviously create some well-educated young men and women that have a great skill set that they can bring back to their communities and make use of. So I believe subject to your questions, Mr. Chairman, that's the budget presentation for military affairs.
All right. Any questions from anyone on the committee? Good. All right. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
General
Mr. Chairman and committee members and staff, thanks for allowing us the time to come over and testify on our state operating budget. And thanks for agreeing to the priorities that Governor Dayton included in our budget that you're supporting. And we understand, certainly, during these daunting times for the legislature, the work that you have to do trying to balance the state's budget. But we certainly appreciate your concern and that you've shown for your Minnesota National Guard and the Department of Military Affairs and our citizen soldiers and airmen, their families and employers. Thank you for your continued support for their federal wartime mission that we're currently doing as we speak here today, as well as our state and community missions that we're always prepared to do, and certainly with the historic possible flood fight that we're on the verge of doing over the next 2 or 3 weeks, so they're back supporting their communities. So, again, we appreciate the opportunity to come before this great committee. Thank you.
Real quick, General Nash, preparation. I know I met you down in Mankato with the governor on flood preparation. Could you just give us a quick update where the Guard is at?
Sure. I'd be happy to, Mr. Chairman. Senator Perry spoke about the governor and I, Director of Homeland Security, Emergency Management, Director ID, Public Safety, the Commissioner of Public Safety, and the Commissioner of Commerce have traveled around the state. We've been to Crookston and Moorhead, Montevideo, Jordan, Mankato, Winona, and also South St. Paul and Stillwater, talking to the communities, doing town halls, and been great turnouts, as Senator Perry can attest to, in Mankato. Engaging the citizens and the first responders, the sheriffs, the county responders, in terms of where we are. In the state of Minnesota with the Guard, we prepared three different locations throughout the state. In the Red River Valley, we have a battalion of individuals ready. A battalion is about 1,000 individuals, men and women, with a command and control headquarters to be able to respond to that Red River Valley area. We also have another battalion, the first of the 151 out of Montevideo, prepared to respond to the lower Minnesota River up through New Ulm and Montevideo, Mankato, Lee Seward, Jordan, which is currently in the news now. And then we have another battalion, the 682nd Engineers, are prepared to respond in the lower portion of the Minnesota, the Mississippi, and the St. Croix going down into the Winona area. So each one of those three areas we have prepared our soldiers for and have operation orders ready to execute. Lessons learned from the past have been incorporated into that. Tabletop exercises have been prepared, working with the local sheriffs who really request, and that's where the request comes to the governor through the Homeland Security Emergency Management Director ID, to call out the Guard. And so we expect in the next few days those sheriffs will execute their plans once they've expended all local resources before they call the Guard. And going back to what Mr. Palmer had stated, at that point, you know, with emergency management, Chris Idy will then request those federal funds, FEMA, to make us whole again for state and equipment. And so the fuel that we use, the aviation that we have available, transportation, we fully would expect then that we would be reimbursed. We, the general fund, the state of Minnesota, reimbursed for the expenses of our soldiers, their time and equipment. But we are prepared to respond with aviation, communications, medical, transportation, recovery, traffic control points to augment the local sheriffs, local authorities across the state, wherever. And I keep reassuring the local populations that, albeit that we're going to be deploying 2,700 soldiers, men and women, here in May, when we're probably still in the mitigation phase of the flood, we still have over 12,000 airmen and soldiers available to respond to the needs of the citizens of Minnesota, as well as we coordinate with our other states, North Dakota, Wisconsin, and Iowa, the adjutants generals, and we work together. So if we have to share equipment, because some of our equipment is overseas, as you may not know, heavy lift helicopters such as Chinooks, but through the EMAC, we have the capabilities of drawing that in, and we also have soldiers that are able to respond to other states through the EMAC process. And so it's just not military, it's for all first responders. And certainly, if you remember back in Katrina, all 54 states, territories, and District of Columbia responded to Mississippi and Louisiana through that EMAC program. So that's always available for us. So I try to go out and assure the population that we're able to respond, Senator Perry. And I hope we did that well in Mankato, as we've done the other seven cities around Minnesota where we expect flooding to be happening.
Senator Dibble?
Slightly different subject, Mr. Chair. General, was the young man who passed away in the accident, the Minot employee, was he National Guard?
Mr. General Chairman. Nash. Senator Dibble, I'm not aware of that. I only heard about the name this morning, the 9-year employee of the Department of Transportation.
Right.
I'm not tracking, though, sir, if he was a member.
He was in the Guard of the Reserves, but in any case, as part of the military family, so we send our condolences. No,
thank you, Senator. I appreciate that.
Anything further? Thank you, gentlemen. Oh, Senator Gazelka.
I've got the A3 amendment.
I think that's for the, we're going to hold that one. That'll be for Veterans Affairs.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
General, have a great day. Next up will be Department of Veterans Affairs. Please state your name.
Mr. Chair, I am Reggie Wurls, Deputy Commissioner of Programs and Services for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, along with our Financial Director, Mrs. Sherry Crumb-Schroeder.
Well, Deputy Commissioner, members, I would like to let you know that the Deputy Commissioner was recently married over the weekend, and I think you put off your honeymoon just to be here today, correct?
Yes, and she's not very happy about it.
please continue.
They're a lot less fun than I.
In the interest of time, Mr. Commissioner, Chair, we have provided detailed budget overviews of our department and activities in previous committees, so we will not provide an in-depth budget overview to the committee at this point in time. We have reviewed the language for the omnibus bill, and we are very pleased with the language. We believe that it will allow us to provide the level of service that we need to our veteran community. We do have one concern with regards to the higher education veterans program, where we don't have funding for the years 14 and 15. And the of course, the language has repealed the sunset date, so we're concerned how we would be able to fund that program in the outgoing years. Otherwise, after reviewing the language, we feel very, very confident that we will be able to continue on with our current mission of serving veterans, and we appreciate the thought and the compassion that was put in by the committee and the governor to ensure that we're able to fulfill our commitment to the veteran community.
Any questions? I think you're getting off pretty easy here, Mr. Waltz.
My wife and I appreciate it.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now I'll move the A3 amendment.
Senator Gazelka moves the A3 amendment. Mr. Bodern.
What this amendment does is basically, when you look at on page 16, line 3, you'll see that this caps the existing statutory open appropriation for the GI Bill to a specific dollar amount that's shown in the spreadsheet. The language that's being added in the amendment would make it clear that if the appropriation that's provided in the first year is insufficient, then the appropriation from the second year could be made available in the first year and vice versa.
Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I think it's an excellent amendment and
all right.
Support.
On Senator Gazelka's A3 amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Amendment prevails. Any further questions for the commissioner before?
Yes.
Senator
Yes,
Weider.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, just on the sufficiency argument, and you know, I had asked the some of the reps from the military on a couple programs. First, I asked about Yellow Ribbon, and we had earlier presentation, and I asked, are the resources that we're committing right now, are they enough, or with the recognizing the federal government provides quite a bit, but there's a lot of activity going on throughout the state, as you're aware. And with that, if the question is, are we going to be able to respond? The response that I had in talking to them is that there is enough funds right now, and they don't need any additional, because I was certainly wanting to look at what could be done. We've had recent meetings in my own district, as across the state, and was prepared to offer something that would make sure we could meet that demand. But the response was that we're fine where we're at. So I just wanted to share that for the record, and I'm not going to present an amendment that would increase what something that I thought initially may not have been sufficient to meet demand. A second, and I don't need a response on that unless they're so inclined, but the second item, when I was looking under some of the direct appropriations to organizations, the VFWs, the Legions, and various service groups, I believe there's nine or so that are selected, and I had a question as to whether the organization for the POWs, the MIAs, why they aren't specifically mentioned in statute. I asked one of the staff members if he could check that out. I don't know if there's a response there yet. We have a resolution later addressing this important topic. Many communities across our state take this very seriously, responsibly, and you know, consistent with small appropriations that are made for groups. I was wondering why this one wasn't specifically mentioned for the prisoner of war and missing in action groups.
We'll ask staff to respond, Mr. Halverson.
Generally, the language refers to the congressionally chartered veterans organizations. I'd have to double check to see if that's an organization that is congressionally chartered. That's just not included in the language here. But the umbrella of the congressional charter is what this particular section has applied to in the past.
Commissioner,
Mr. Chair, Senator Wigger, the MIAPOW are a congressional chartered congressional organization. However, if I am recalling correctly, appropriations are made to the offices or to the service organizations that have claims offices. Now, I'm not 100% sure on that, but we will get back to you on that today.
Okay, and thank you, Commissioner. And you know, Mr. Chair, I know we're going to tentatively close up Article 2 in a few minutes, but with that understanding, if there's some additional evidence that might see this as an opportunity to address that, I would appreciate it.
Certainly. We'll do that.
Thank you.
Do we have any testifiers here today in this part? Seeing none, Senator Gazelka?
It's tough sometimes. Thanks, Mr. Chair. I renew my motion that Article 2 of the Delete All Amendment be adopted as amended.
On Senator Gazelka's motion, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you. Thank you very much. You're free to go back on your honeymoon, Commissioner.
Thank you very much.
And Mr. Chair?
Senator Olson.
Chair, Commissioner, and don't let Senator Wieger's request for information hold it up.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. I'll quote you.
I delegate to staff.
Yeah. Okay. Next on the list, I understand the humanities would like to testify. Please state your name.
Thank you. I am David O'Fallon, president of the Minnesota Humanities Center.
Proceed, Mr. O'Fallon.
Thank you. Well, I really come before the committee to say thank you indeed very much for preserving the essential funding for the Humanities Center that we use to leverage much other funding. As you understand from some previous testimony, we're small. And yet, in a time when every single dollar counts, the appropriation that you have recommended would be extremely valuable. As you know from my previous remarks, I'm absolutely committed to programs that have impact and results. We're fundamentally an education center, and we do serve the whole state. We have a $250,000 per year appropriation. You have reduced that simply by 5%. That will have a modest impact on us. We'll adjust, but we intend to put all available resources behind programs that have real results. So it's in that spirit that I come before you today, really to say thank you for the support and our commitment to being innovative and entrepreneurial and to have results.
Go ahead, Senator Dibble, go ahead.
Thanks, thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. O'Fallon is my constituent, so I'll ask the first question. Mr. Chair, it's really not about the Humanities Commission, but it's about the transfers of the various councils funding to the humanities.
Keep me to it.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll let you ask the question.
No, that's fine. I was just because Senator Cohen isn't here, and I didn't know if he'd talked to you or you remembered that that was a question he asked last night. So,
kind of keying off that. Just curious, Mr. O'Fallon, what your understanding of that proposal is, how you see that fitting with the Humanities Commission or not, which you're free to say, and you know, if this does happen, how you would envision handling that new responsibility.
Mr. O'Fallon.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dibble, it's my understanding that all of us are concerned about, especially in a very tight budget time, effectiveness and collaboration and partnership. As some of you know, because of the legacy funding, there's been a working relationship between the councils and the Humanities Center now for the last couple of years. That's been focused on education, both in schools and beyond schools and across the state. That is the expertise, if you will, of the Humanities Center. If the intent of this is to create greater collaboration and partnership, then we will be the best possible citizens we can be to make this happen. The exact language was came out last night in the committee. I've had a chance to touch base with a couple of the exec directors of the council. I think we need to sit down at the same table together and kind of come to a mutual understanding as to exactly how this might work and go forward from there.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Question for you or for staff. I don't remember the particulars of this proposal. Are these just kind of, how's this working? Are these kind of pass-through grants, or is it kind of a one lump that then gets filled out on a competitive grant basis with some criteria established by the Humanities Commission or Council? How's it working again?
Senator Dibble, are you talking about the dollars they get from the legacy fund or the general fund dollars?
The general fund dollars, Mr. Chair.
Well, I'll take a whack at it as I understand it, is that these are funds that are used in the councils, so then decide how to disperse. Mm-hmm. I'll say it, the reason I felt that this is the right direction to go is because what I have heard from the communique of the councils, that they're all working on the same type of issues, mm-hmm. and I felt at this time, having it under humanities, where we can pull them all together under one heading and really focus on the dollars, if they're being used in, I mean, so we don't have duplicative services going on at one time. And I think it's easier to pull everything together under one head so that they come together. Okay, then let's move forward with it that way. Is that...
Yes, thanks. Thanks, Mr. Chair. So then that allows me then. So, Mr. O'Fallon, do you envision then bringing the councils together somehow and combining some of their? I mean, I see a lot of what the councils do as wholly outside the mission of what you would think of under a traditional humanities council, mm-hmm. in the area of how I view humanities, of course, is the classic sense of arts, culture, language, sociology, history, et cetera.
Right.
The councils do all of that, you know, particularly the Indian Affairs Council in trying to keep dying languages alive, et cetera. But you know, the Black Minnesotans Council deals with current policy affairs that are, you know, hot issues of the moment, making policy recommendations. That would be kind of outside the the purview of the Humanities Council or Commission. So how do you see the Council's keeping with their mission, which is separate from what the Humanities do, and also combining some of the ideas that Senator Perry has articulated?
Mr. O'Fallon.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, it's the exactly how this plays out is not entirely clear to me. If I understand the language as currently written, it is the Center for the Humanities making a grant to the councils. And that would be pretty clean and passed through, and the language even says the councils each independently will report back to the legislature on the results of their funding. I do know, and we've had some, again, very good collaborative conversations in my time, in my recent time at the Humanities Center, on collaboration with the councils and across the councils. And I think, as I have mentioned in front of this committee, the councils themselves, when asked what some of their top priorities were, every single one said education. And education is, of course, the strength in many ways of the Humanities Center. To the point, however, that you made, the fact is that the councils have other responsibilities. They do advise the governor and the state on policy matters, for example, on some issues of economic development and so forth that are not really, we're not experts at that at the Humanities Center. So how all that would absolutely play out, I'm not myself sure of at this stage.
And Senator Dibble, just, you know, also I'm thinking that part of this was to have that fiscal agent so that, you know, because of the economies of scales, and I do, you know, I think I will share this with the committee if somebody could hand it out. This is the, after we had called to get reports from the councils, the Chicano Latino Affairs Council, Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, and Council on the Black Minnesotans sent us one communique via email. And I want you to read it because it, and this is where this kind of all started when I started thinking about how can we make sure. It's kind of like in economic development when I would sit on the EDA board, the WDC board, the city council, and it appeared that we all had common goals, but no one head that would put it together and make sure that we're doing the best we can with all those dollars. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Dr. O'Fallon, you have a board for the Humanities Commission, and these councils each have their respective boards. But would this mean that there would, because of your handling the grants and funds, would that give some fiduciary responsibility and oversight to your board to review the functioning and the appropriateness, if you will? I don't know if it's appropriateness is the right word, but mm-hmm. but at least to monitor that fiduciary aspect of the councils.
Mr. O'Fallon.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, on a basic factual level, my understanding is that any grant-making function by an agency like ours, you do accept fiduciary responsibility for that. I want to emphasize again, however, the fact that, you know, the councils have years of history and constituents and so on, and have addressed issues that are, I would, to be quite honest, say beyond the normal working experience of a humanities center. Where we are clearly excellent collaborators is when we look at sort of cultural development, community development, education impact, and so forth. And there, I think there is probably room for cooperation and effectiveness yet to be explored. We're fairly new partners, as you recall. The legacy funding really kind of put us all in the same kind of partnership relationship. So, again, in the spirit of good citizenship and cooperation, I think we'd all try to work forward on this. And we'd need to figure out exactly what the mechanisms are that might work well.
Thank you. Well, Mr.
Senator
Chair,
Olson.
I noted there's a provision later in this bill that relates to sunsetting of a lot of things, and there's a cluster of the councils that are sunset, mm-hmm. But with the idea of oversight, I wonder if the I didn't see the root of that, if that's the legislative responsibility to do the oversight and make decisions as to whether those are reinstated or not, or in the case of these councils, would that fall to the Humanities Commission to give analysis and direction on that? Because that's That was in the earliest batch.
And if it would be all right when we get to that, I think.
But
we
I
can
just want to alert on that because I think there is a connection here that.
Right. That's right. Any further questions of Mr. O'Fallon? Thank you very much, sir.
Could I make one more comment,
yes,
Mr.
Sir.
Chairman? I understand that the councils are often treated exactly sort of in the same framework. I do feel, though, that to point out that the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council really represents sovereign nations. So the issues that I think and the purview and the range of matters that come before that particular body are, in fact, I think in some ways broader and even deeper in history. I just want to acknowledge this because it does color, indeed, look at how we might connect and correspond. I would emphasize again the positive nature, the cooperative nature of the relationship between the center and each of these councils.
Thank you, sir. Are there anyone here from any of the councils?
Right there.
Please step forward. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Anna Marie Hill, and I'm the Executive Director of the Indian Affairs Council.
Welcome, Ms. Hill. Proceed.
Let me see. There's so much to say. I just read the bill. I saw the percentage of cut that you recommended was 13% for the Indian Affairs Council. And I do want to tell you, I too am committed to making that percentage work in the Indian Affairs Council. So on that note, I also agree with Dr. O'Fallon's testimony that we have made terrific partners in our work together with the humanities. That relationship began with the legacy money that we received in the last biennium. And but if there's one thing, most of you are new to working with me, with the exception of a couple people that I know from working with in the past. One of the things that I've sought in the past 5 years as executive director is to be as creative as possible as executive director in Indian Affairs to solve some of the issues in the American Indian community. So I continually look for partners to come to the table to work with the Indian Affairs Council on some of the most serious issues that plague the communities of the American Indian people. This involves creativity and it involves a lot of innovation and it involves serious partners. I do have to state that in its current context, Indian Affairs Council is good and it works. We have a very large member board and representation. We have 28 individual people that come to the table, or though that should come to the table to work on some of these most serious problems in the Indian community that affect the entire state of Minnesota. We have legislators, we have commissioners, we have all of the tribal nations that come to the table, and we have the governor's office. And I'm of the firm belief, and my experience, I believe, proves this, and my personal beliefs, as many people as possible coming together to solve these problems that continue to plague our communities is the best possible way that we can move forward. And so it has worked, it does work, and as a matter of fact, it's been happening in the state of Minnesota since 1963. I can easily remember that number because that's exactly the year of my birth. So in 2 years, we'd be celebrating the 50-year anniversary of the Indian Affairs Council. And since that time, when we began, I can only imagine that at that time, a lot of Indian people didn't have, and I do remember this very young and visiting Indian homes, there was no electricity, there were no lights, there were no fancy lawns, and there were basically a lot of homes that we would consider our aunts and uncles and our cousins living in complete destitution. In many cases, that still exists around this country, and for those of us who have who have been out in the field working directly with a lot of communities, those places do exist. They continue to exist in Minnesota. In many ways, we've advanced. We've solved a lot of the electrical problems, the plumbing problems. But even 10 years ago, when I was working as a legislative director for Red Lake Reservation, we were still looking at a 50 or 60% unemployment rate on the reservation. And we were working as hard as we could to solve these problems. And when we worked to solve these problems, we came here to discuss these problems with all of you, to come to the table and say, how are we going to solve the problems? How are we going to create an employment setting for people? How are we going to get people good jobs? How are we going to get people good health care, good education? State of Minnesota, I thought up until last week that we had the worst disparity rate between the American Indian people in education in the nation, the second worst, but we are, in fact, the worst in the nation. So I believe that we still have to continue to come together. Now, again, I'm willing to work with the legislature in any way that I can to help solve the budget problems. We all are. However, I don't exactly understand the language as it is written as a pass-through grant. I cannot see how the entity that would obtain the grant wouldn't be the controlling entity, and that the other entity wouldn't basically cease to exist in its current form. However, if we continued in the current form, and I know your concern is that many of the communities are working on some of the same issues, so per se talking about things that would actually be a duplicative service on this end, maybe not being economically sound in some opinion, but we would, if we continue to receive the pass-through grant, it appears to me that we would remain working on those duplicative services unless our construction at the other end would be in fact different, or we would be absorbed into a humanities construct. So I am a little bit confused about that. So with that, that's right now what I have to say, other than we hope to continue being of value of each and every one of you who are here, and that and again, we are the indigenous people of this nation, and there's a lot of history there, and we have been working hard to bring that history and that education to people, in addition to this, to help with the issues that we all continue to remain with in the state of Minnesota. So with that, I will answer any questions. Oh, and this is Pete Palma. He is our cultural resources director. Big part of what we do to it.
Excuse me, I'm the specialist. I have a boss. He's the director.
Thank you, Ms. Hill. Senator Cohen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hill, is there somebody on the council from every one of the individual bands in the state?
Yeah.
Ms. Hill?
Currently, 10 out of the 11 bands participate in the state of Minnesota on the Indian Affairs Council. They're named in statute as all members or board members, but that is an optional representation.
Okay.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, just a comment. obviously, last night we had some discussion. We'll get back to it in terms of, you know, some concerns I have with a couple bigger pieces in the bill. Certainly, I think in terms of the cuts suggested by the chairman, I can, as I think I mentioned, disagree with some of them. But in terms of maybe the amount, it should be a little bit less, or, you know, something like that. But don't disagree with the thrust of a lot of what's in the bill. This is an issue I'm trying to kind of grasp, and I think particularly in terms of the, and I have some concerns about the other minority councils. But I'm trying to figure out how, in particular, the Indian Affairs Council operates within the structure of the Humanities Commission, given, additionally, that there are geographic issues and involvements with the Indian Affairs Council, where you do have, you know, the bands and reservations throughout the state. And so I'm not sure how, you know, does this end up ultimately at the end of the day become form over substance, where you just kind of put everything within, you don't get any economies of scale. And again, I wonder if the geography plays into that as well, because that's a uniqueness, you know, relative to the Indian Affairs Council. And again, got some questions about the other minority councils, but I think in particular the geography makes this a little bit different. Now, maybe I'm just, you know.
Ms. Hill, how does your council come together now, the different tribes, when you have your meetings and when?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator Cohen, we come from all throughout the state of Minnesota. 11 tribes participate, well, 10 right now. And we come together on a quarterly basis, and we basically choose the location. So we decide whether we're going to travel. Now we have locations that we can go to on the reservation, so we do that. We also meet in the metro area. We just met recently, about a month ago, over here at the Kelly Inn. So we met, and that's how we come together. We are able to come together, of course, by conference calling. Now, since the statute was changed a couple years ago, that allowed all state agencies to participate in conference calling to be up to date with the innovation so that exists today. And I might say that we did lead that effort in Indian Affairs because we have a large population representing. We represented the entire state of Minnesota, and we do all come together.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Please state your name.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Eileen Herr, and I'm the Executive Director for the State Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, and it is my pleasure to be in front of you once again. In response to our budget bill, and last time we presented on our agencies, but today we're actually talking about hard numbers, and I did have a brief conversation with the other council directors, Black Council, and then also Chicano Latino Affairs Council, and we are all more than willing to do our fair share of taking reduction to help meet the state's budget deficit, and so we're all more than happy to take our fair share. One of the things that I would say about my agency in particular, because, of course, I'm authorized to speak on my agency and not on the others' two behalf, but I want to put forth that my agency is the best vehicle that this state can create to reach out to all the Asian Pacific community throughout the state of Minnesota. And that is actually invaluable in that the community came to you all in 1985 saying, you need input from the community as you're building the state to be better. And what vehicle can best be used for that? The response was, the state has advisory boards, and let's create an advisory board for the Asian Pacific community that then would work with the community and bring back advice to us, the legislature and the governor and his cabinet. I think we've played a pretty good role in terms of offering our advice to you and knowing the beat and the issues, the tough issues within the community. I don't know, and first of all, I would say that if I had to be married to anyone else, the Humanity Center, I would pick. And so they are a great organization, and we've worked fabulously with them. But it's all because of their philosophy and the staffing dynamics that they have. So I wouldn't know if David left, what would be the outcome of in the future. But in its current state right now, I mean, it's a great partner, and I think we're both very interested in producing outcomes, truly collaborating on cultural issues, educational issues, raising the attainment of our students. With that being said, I think the value here, and I thank you all for recognizing that there is a value that the councils represent, that the council can bring to the table, and that is that advice from our community, bringing to you the thoughts and the values of importance to our community, bringing that to the table, and that's something that's still worthy of investment. I don't know in what form that would take in the future with in terms of this partnership. Would we then cease to be a state advisory board, and in what capacity would we exist? But that's something that I think is very new to us, and it's something that we need to discuss with our boards, among each other, and then also with the Humanities Center And that's something that I am definitely open to, because I want to be innovative. I want to be able to do my fair share. Thank you.
You know, I get excited, Ms. Herr, when I hear that kind of positive attitude from both of you, Ms. Hill, and because that's what we're really trying to do here. That's what I would like to see done. And I can only go back to my managing of numerous radio stations, and we found that when we started bringing those entities together, we found so many different. We came up with a lot of great ideas, by the way, that made all of them better. And using economies of scale and creative ideas that maybe you have, Ms. Herr and Ms. Hill, and be able to use it. And that's why, in my thought process, using Mr. O'Fallon and the humanities as let's get us all together, I believe something very, very good will come out of this, and make every council even better than they are today. But I like your positive attitude. Thank you very much. Any further questions? Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, with apologies, four of us have been in Senator Michelle's committee. That's why we've been late. So I came in as Mr. O'Fallon was speaking. I just have one other question about this. Is there the physical space within the Humanities Center to house all the consuls?
Mr. O'Fallon, would you like to respond to that? And just before you respond, the language doesn't that require that at this time, but not to say that down the road it might. Go ahead, Mr. O'Fallon.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Cohen, the short answer to that would probably be tight fit. I think that we haven't contemplated how all of us might actually be housed in the same facility. It's a conversation I'm sure we could have at some point. But, Mr. Chairman, as your language, as you point out, the language doesn't demand or indicate that that necessarily has to happen. I think, you know, you guys are extremely experienced legislators. You've seen many projects come and go. You've heard our testimony today briefly. I think what would be very helpful would be an opportunity for all of us to do some serious thinking, coordinating, planning. Some elements may work best coordinated and collaborated. There may be, for example, policy making and unique presentations from the community roles that are different, that need to have a different structure. I don't know the answer to these things yet.
And I guess I would also throw in here, I mean, obviously if we wanted to, we could legislate a meeting, but, you know, the willingness that I have heard from everyone to really take a good long hard look at this and be able to come up with smart decisions and be able to come back with to us with that at whatever time that might be, again, that gets me excited about this. So, all right, thank you very much.
Testimony?
We'll check with the
testimony, otherwise we can list it for tonight.
We do have groups that are listed for tonight ready to testify. Is anyone else here that might be interested? If not, we're going to recess. Seeing none, we will resume with excuse me.
I'm here, so if it's okay.
Sure. Come forward. Please state your name.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International, R&R Family Centers, and head of APAC, the Asia Pacific America Housing Consortium. Children's Hope International, R&R Family Centers, is a private nonprofit group in business since 1974 and has never received government funds. Our core areas are economic development, education, healthcare, housing, justice, public policy, technology, and victim services. We do more than the same things that many other organizations have testified that they receive government funds on. APAC has over 15 unfunded API service providers, but we also include realtors, lenders, developers, and others in the housing industry, and it's growing. We service over 200,000 in the API community, plus services are extended to all other Minnesotans. We have targets of service to over 400,000 veterans in one initiative. Last year, we drafted a policy that's still in the process where we would house all the homeless people. And by the various numbers that have been quoted as to how many homeless veterans there are, we are working on a project to house them all. I'm a former corporate auditor for companies, which includes Fortune 500 companies, a former financial executive, realtor, and lender. I'm still a small business owner, a general contractor, developer, and do grant reviews and audits of programs. I have an MBA, I was a CPA, and I currently have certifications as a housing counselor and educator. We do things by pioneering in a number of areas, innovating, doing things better, smarter, faster, more efficiently, more effectively. We are currently working on some projects at the state, national, and international level that will create jobs, generate good returns on investment, target large populations, and generate billions in revenue. Now, the reason I was testifying on this was that your committee is looking at various projects that support the veterans groups. In some areas, there are duplication of services that are currently being provided by LSS under CORE, or if it's not under CORE, it's under their general service groups. Most of the agencies have gone through the Jobs and Economic Development Committee and Minnesota Housing Finance Agency to get their funds regarding housing, and many have testified in the Jobs and Economic Committee on how they house veterans. But they also house active military, and we're working on an issue there because our outreach, we have members in our consortium that are global, so our reach is going global. The other reason we wanted to testify was that we believe there's a better and more efficient way of being able to service the military, and this is an area that we have focused on. We just wanted to let the committee members know of some of the other groups that have been working on the issues. For example, the Coalition for the Homeless is a membership of over 150 organizations, and that is chiefly the focus area that they're working on. These groups include large philanthropic foundations, businesses, government officials, and others. So by pooling all these different parties working on the issues, I do believe, you know, we can better address it, and then we don't have to overuse your tapped resources just by working better and smarter. So this is why I wanted to mention this to you. And right now we're trying to see how we could get all the groups to collaborate to address the issues in a more productive and efficient and common sense way. So I just wanted to raise the issue to this committee. Also, where something was raised as far as, oh, only veterans can service other veterans because they know what they're going through. Well, the point is, I come from a family that we have all served in the military, and our relatives too, and it extends for generations. So we're very familiar with services to this population, and there are others who are in the community who don't identify as so-called veterans groups servicing veterans, but they are within some of the existing organizations, many that you have heard of, and we ask that you consider them as resources, and also because they're being funded by state dollars anyway, so thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Lee, and I know you're working hard, and thank you very much.
We have a new program that will be a model for the nation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, please come forward. Please state your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Brad Leto. I'm the chief of staff for the Minnesota AFL-CIO, which is a labor organization of some 1,000 affiliated unions, actually one right to my left here, and about 300,000 union members and their families. At the beginning of the legislative session, we distributed to all legislators here kind of three priorities, I guess, if you will, to look forth in the session. And the first was to retain and create middle class good wage jobs and benefits, balance the state budget with revenue included as part of the solution, and thirdly, to stay focused on those above two provisions. For that reason, we didn't put forth a We did put forth an agenda for some of those things that could meet that, but we actually didn't put forth a lot of bills because we thought those first two were the most important criteria. In analyzing the committee bill, I'd say, unfortunately, the third part about staying focused, I think there's some provisions in the bill that unfortunately don't do that. And you've heard, and you'll hear more testimony specifically on the collective bargaining, on the contracting out, on some of the other provisions in the bill that I don't really, first of all, I think they should be collectively bargained. The salary freeze is an example. I think if you've heard before, and you'll probably hear again, that unions certainly have not been, the members of organized labor have not been getting rich through collective bargaining, and have actually time and time again through collective bargaining have taken either zeros and actually on other health care and other things have sacrificed. We don't believe that this bill actually helps retain or create good wage jobs, middle class jobs. And I understand that you don't raise revenue through this committee. However, there are 13 members of this committee, and if that's over a third of the votes needed to raise revenue in the state Senate of 34 votes, so you need 21 more votes to actually include revenue as part of the solution. So I guess for that reason, we have problems with especially Article 3 of the bill, but would encourage you to look at those provisions again. Thank you very much, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Leto. Please state your name.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carrie Mortrude, and I'm with the Minnesota Nurses Association.
Could you spell your last name?
Sure. Please. M-O-R-T as in Tom, R-U-D as in dog.
Thank you.
You're welcome. As Brad said, we are here on behalf of over the 700 nurses that we represent in state service. We have 20,000 members, but we do have over 700 specifically in state service that work with the veterans, our mentally ill, and those that are incarcerated. And when I was here a few weeks ago and testified on the 15% reduction in workforce in 2015, I spoke to the short staffing that some of our nurses are working with, which puts them and the patients in danger. And that one of the questions from one of the senators, I believe it was Senator Thompson, was that it didn't have to be a reduction in staff. It could be a reduction in other ways. But with the wage freeze and the possible workforce reduction, as well as some of the pension bills, we'd see this workforce suffer greatly. And taking care of these folks and working corrections is not really at the top of most new grads' list coming out of nursing. So for those reasons, specifically Section 33, the salary freeze, and Section 36, the workforce reduction, the Minnesota Nurses Association opposes Senate File 604. And I'd be happy to take any questions. Otherwise, thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Moitra. State your name, please.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. I'm Richard Kajewski, Legislative Affairs Director for the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees. You want me to spell that one, Mr. Chair?
I do it phonetically, sir.
So do I, Mr. Chair.
Proceed.
Mr. Chair, just three main provisions I want to focus on. The 15% state workforce reduction. Generally funded employees, that's about 1 in 6 of the entire state workforce. And I know, Mr. Chair, this bill isn't prescriptive as to where these employees come from, but this is going to be problematic in the agencies. We're not sitting on a fat state government. We're one of the 10th leanest workforces in the country. On top of the job cuts that are already proposed throughout the different budget divisions, this is going to compound the problem. There's cuts to employees. There's going to be cuts to positions. There's going to be cuts to vacancies that remain open in these budgets. And adding another 15% of the workforce is going to make this a huge problem in many different divisions that, frankly, Mr. Chair, are not going to be exempt from these cuts. The second provision is the salary freeze. We believe this is a term and condition of our bargaining conditions. We've always pitched in and worked with the administration. When there's been budget cuts and deficits, Mr. Chair, labor has come to the table. Labor's accepted 4 years of wage freezes in the last 8. We've accepted increases in health insurance costs and out-of-pocket costs. And, Mr. Chair, this legislature has always had the opportunity to do what that provision is doing. The Legislative Coordinating Commission has to act on our contract or it takes effect. Then the collective bargaining agreements all come before this specific committee and move through the legislature, which has the option to approve or not approve the collective bargaining agreements. So, Mr. Chair, the legislature already gets their say without mandating a wage freeze and without actually going in and taking away collective bargaining rights. The last piece, the high deductible plan. Mr. Chair, as Mr. Leto already testified to, our employees are not getting rich off of state government. This is another way just to limit labor's rights to bargain for health care and benefits. This is an approximate $9,000 shift per state employee. $9,000 based on the use today. In 2007, 62% of all bankruptcies were health care related. 78% of those people had health insurance of some sort. Mr. Chair, our employees in the EPI study already make 16.7% less than the private sector counterparts, and we're attempting in this provision to shift another $9,000 in costs onto state employees. Mr. Chair, with that, I'll stand for any questions, but we ask that you reconsider some of these provisions in that section of the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. We will resume testimony this evening at 6:30. Members in room 112. We have a number of commissioners and testifiers this evening, and for those that might be listening or watching,